be going to Myrtle Beach in an hour, but right now it's time to go back in time with Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, as we take a look at this week in history another round of History Matters. How are you?
Doing good. And, you know, you're absolutely right. It is like time traveling. Diana Gabaldon, who wrote, of course, the Outlander series, voted like second most popular book other than To Kill a Mockingbird recently on PBS. She got it right. It is a lot like time travel when we go back and we think about that time and that place and in history when these things happen.
Was Outlander number two on that? I heard To Kill a Mockingbird was number one. I didn't hear what was number two.
It was Outlander. And you know, it was
recount.
It even topped, let's see, the Harry Potter books and Frankenstein and a whole bunch of other ones that are like,
okay,
you're kidding.
All right. I'll have to check out those books.
And I thought, why did I not bump into these books so many years ago? And I thought, I realized finally, you know, they're so thick that they're just not in many used bookstores or people hold on to them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You don't see them a lot.
Okay.
And, best kept secret. But now, of course, there's the series on TV about this and all. But
That is a good sign of a really good book or a really bad book that you can't find it in a used bookstore, either because people buy them and hang on to them or they don't buy them in the first place. But
right.
It's definitely one or the other.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, before we go back way in time, let's go back a few days. How was Bill of Rights Day, the bell ringing in Hillsborough?
It was wonderful. We had the weather was not the greatest, but so we had maybe fewer people, but we had more bells being rung. And at the courthouse, and I was lamenting the fact that it was closed, it was Saturday, and then Mayor Tom Stevens shows up with Debbie, and he says, well, would you like me to ring the bell? And I said, you mean the one up top? He said, yes. I was like, I have never heard
done
that.
And done.
That's right. Yeah. So he rang that bell and gave a few of the others of us there a chance to ring it as well. And I don't even know how far back that bell goes. The other one that's right downstairs, which used to hang in the couple up above, is an 1805 bell.
Oh, wow.
Built by a fellow who immigrated to the United States in 1793 and then built these kind of bells for the next 20 years. They're found all over the United States. And that one still has a great sound to it. It's really cool.
Moved to the U.S. in 1793 and learned from the mistakes of the people who made the Liberty Bell that just cracked immediately upon first ring.
Actually, he was a master bell maker. So when he came over here, his skills were good.
Okay.
I did talk to somebody that day who said, she said, do you know when the last time the Liberty Bell was rung? And I said, oh, I don't know. She said, well, I can tell you, it was about 20 years ago. I said, what do you mean? She said, my husband bumped into it and it rang the clangor. I said, I don't think there's been any more repeat incidents.
That's hilarious.
But it was really great. And in fact, just as we were starting, I could hear one of the bells up the street from the church belfries. And that's the really cool part about it. So
yeah, that's cool.
Great stuff. And it's such a important kind of a thing to remember. And in fact, that just ties in with something else that goes on this week, which is on December 17th, 1776, is when the 5th Provincial Congress of North Carolina met in Halifax and issued the North Carolina Declaration of Rights. So, you know, we think of the Bill of Rights, and that's 1789 when they get introduced, and finally they're ratified in 1791. Mm-hmm. But long before this, North Carolina was out there saying these rights were there. In fact, that's part of the reason why the state gets involved in the Regulator Movement, because all of these things that we hold so essential to who we are as Americans, part of our DNA, is part of what the North Carolina was all about from the beginning.
And it's North Carolina here, but it's all of these state bills of rights and state declarations of rights that got people talking about a Bill of Rights on the national level in the first place. So this is the beginning of that.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's right. And then some people like Madison thought, well, if we get the main constitution in 1787, that's enough. All these states have Declaration of Rights. But it's North Carolina that actually raises this important question, which is, well, which one are we following? Because they're all worded slightly differently, and there should be a Declaration of Rights. And that is the case that carries the day for North Carolina, postponing, voting to postpone ratifying the Constitution.
And both sides were right on that, because on the one hand, you think about the way that American government has developed. Now you've got many, many cases over the course of the last 200 years where the government would have done something that's an egregious violation of rights had it not been for these provisions in the Constitution. On the other hand, you had Alexander Hamilton, who made the really good argument that, well, if we list these rights, then we're going to get it into our heads that these are the only ones that are protected and there aren't any others. And we've had those developments, too, where rights that are definitely ours that aren't in the Bill of Rights. It's a harder argument to make.
And he made that argument at the Constitution.
Yes.
Convention, which is another thing that's really kind of interesting. So that carried the day, his persuasiveness, apparently saying, you know, that's enough.
Right.
But then you look at what was crafted that does go out. And, you know, I suggest anybody who, you know, thinks the Constitution is too dense, or go back and read it and at least read those first 10 amendments. There's a sparsity of language, but there's also I dare anyone to write them better. That can be so inclusive. And they also provided some checks and balances, enough to satisfy so many people, especially those who said, gee, if we leave out some, are we really going to be stuck? No. So anyways, that's what we're celebrating. The next day on the 18th is when the North Carolina's Constitution gets brought in 1776.
Yep.
So cool stuff,
awesome.
Part of the real American history. And, of course, there was a lot of colonial history this week, including a note about Valley Forge.
Yes.
December 19th, 1777, the Continental Army enters this winter encampment at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And now, and they're there for the next few months, and, of course, it's a harsh winter. We've heard about this. We've seen the reenactments or the paintings, and lots of people die. But the army that comes out of that are trained. They're battle-hardened. They're ready, and they are very disciplined. The interesting thing is I had a real insight. I thought, why aren't they fighting in winter? Well, every February in Hillsboro, they do a Revolutionary War week in February in honor of that week when Cornwallis slunk back to Hillsboro after chasing the wrong army up to Danville, coming back in 1781, and he's in camp for this week. And anyway, so they do this reenactment, and they have reenactors. And so they have these reenactors dressed up as British officers and troops. You know, it's really, you think, oh, yeah, this guy looks like William Tryon, But anyways, they're there. And so on this particular year, it started snowing quite a bit. And I said, finally, you know, I understood there's going to be like a musket demonstration. And it was they gave me such an insight. That one of the persons said, no, we can't do that. It's too wet. And I thought, oh, my goodness.
Oh, man.
I said, you don't do it? He said, no, when it's snowing, you don't. I thought, oh.
Yeah.
This is why you don't find a lot of these battles in the middle of winter.
It's incredible how weather affects all of this.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I mean, even the story of Valley Forge, which doesn't involve any battles at all. It's just the encampment. But so much of that story.
The battle against weather.
Right, is the battle against weather, exactly.
Yeah. It's really kind of the more fascinating elements of, like, what goes into, or even time, time and weather. You know, England is 6 weeks away by boat because it's several thousand miles away. To go round trip, it's about 3 months. There's this huge lag time, which means that the armies here under the British, and especially colonial governors, they are following protocols, but they can exceed those, and there's not a lot of follow up until several months later.
Yeah. Speaking with Scott Washington, History Matters. We got a lot of really big history events. The Wright brothers, December 17th.
That's right, exactly. My gosh, they make that first controlled flight. And I wondered if they always, it was a matter of contention between these brothers. Orville flies his for 12. Wilbur flies it for 59.
Gets off and is like, nope, got that done.
Yeah, we got a good breeze. You're going downhill. but there's some evidence that Gustav Whitehead made some kind of a flight a couple of years earlier, but we don't celebrate the Gustav.
He didn't have a good enough publicist.
No, that's
clearly,
right.
Clearly, yeah.
But certainly the Wright brothers, that is something. That was 1903.
It's so amazing how far I saw a comic recently. I think this was XKCD, but I'm not 100% sure it was online, where the distance in time between the Wright brothers' first flight and the launch of the first, like, John Glenn going into orbit. Yeah. I think we're to the point now where exactly the same amount of time has passed between the Wright brothers and John Glenn as from John Glenn to today.
Oh my gosh,
this is incredible! How much happened in such a short period of time in terms of aviation technology after that first 12-second flight. Like, within minutes, they'd already quadrupled that, and then it just kept going and going.
Well, and of course, you know, we're not even getting into automobiles.
Yes.
And that
comes
even further.
Yeah.
And I got to thinking about it. I thought, you know, when a car is going 55 miles per hour, so are the driver and the occupants. In some ways, when you're driving, you're time traveling.
Because
it does. It saves you time, and you suddenly think, yeah, back in colonial times, whatever distance would be a lot longer, and now you just fly along.
It's also theory of relativity, right? If you're moving at a certain speed, like, that makes time go slower, faster, or something like that. I didn't take physics.
It's a new science
show. But it's in there somewhere.
See how history works. A new segment.
Actual scientists rolling their eyes in their cars even as we speak, which also makes time go faster or slower.
So does laughter. I think those are also a good thing too. Also, this is a week when the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery goes into effect. That's on December 18th, 1865. Now, I should clarify that when this process for amending the Constitution came up in the fifth article, there wasn't really any clarification about, well, when do these take effect?
Mm-hmm.
So when the first original 10 go effect, it's like, well, assume December 15th, that's when they are. But then, if you look at the letters, actually, it's Jefferson certifies it, really, by saying about March 1st, well, I've counted the votes, and it looks like these are going into effect.
Right.
It takes a law that gets passed in the early 1800s to be able to say to Congress, it's the Secretary of State certifies the ratification of the amendments and publishes them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that December 18th date.
Well, it's also a fascinating story with the 13th and 14th Amendment, because that was exactly at the time when the Civil War was coming to an end and states were getting readmitted to the Union. So did those states count for purposes of the three quarters of the states, or do they not?
Oh, yes.
And they used a different answer to that question, like which states count versus which states don't. They answered the question in one way for the 13th Amendment. They answered the question in a different way for the 14th Amendment in order to get them into the Constitution. And that story is fascinating as well.
Yeah. Well, wasn't that one of the price of admission? That
for the 14th Amendment, I think.
All right, was it the 13th
or 14th, yeah.
So, yeah, these are very, very important. So we might have celebrated with bell ringing the first 10, but there's a 13th, 14th, 15th, the 20th Amendment, the 27th Amendment, 26th Amendment. So.
I think it was the 14th Amendment that was the price for admission, because there was that controversy in the early 90s when Mississippi finally got around to ratifying the 13th Amendment.
Well,
I think
those first 10, of course, it was, I think, Massachusetts and Connecticut, maybe Georgia had to finally go back in 1939 when they were reminded, hey, y'all didn't really ratify. But by then, they had the necessary votes in 1791. Like, oh, okay, all right, we'll do that. So
a lot happened in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Ralph Waldo Emerson gave a speech. Everyone threw a hissy fit over that. That took 20 years to resolve.
Yes. So these are
Henry David Thoreau just disappeared. No one knew where he went.
That's
he was
right.
off in the woods. We had to go looking for him.
I have been to Walden Pond. I remember, in fact, growing up in Massachusetts, born in the Midwest, grew up there, then moved down here for many, many years. But up in Massachusetts, we had squirrels in our attic. So we got one of those have a heart traps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the squirrel got in it. And you're wondering, how does this have anything to do with Longfellow Pond? I'll tell you, because the squirrel was rattling around. It was not quiet. And so my dad threw me the keys and said, as a teenager, said, okay, just take the squirrel. So I went a couple miles down the road, and then the next night they were there again, hit the traps again. He said, take it farther away. And I thought, what the heck? So I thought of the farthest place I could go, and we were around Boston. I went to Longfellow Pond in the middle of the night, where Thoreau was, if that's the name of the pond.
Walden Pond. Walden Pond.
And I went there, and then I opened the cage, and I said, we're home, honey. And the squirrel looked at me. Well, there's nobody else. It was hilarious. It was my little Walden Pond moment. I'm sure.
I can't believe I haven't heard this story before.
It's finally coming out. That's because you're such a good interviewer. You just bring out things from people.
Well, clearly not, because we've been doing this for 2 years. I should have brought this out a year and a half ago.
I've been fighting it, Aaron. I've been fighting it. Yes, it was a thoughtful moment, and then I got back in my car, and I'm sure the squirrel laughed about it, and it looked like it shook its head, to be honest, but said I was nuts, but I don't know.
All right,
we have the first basketball game in 1891, December 21st, 1891. A YMCA instructor organizes students and uses a soccer ball and peach baskets. There's no basketballs. And then they had to use a ladder to retrieve the ball from the basket.
No one thought to put a hole in it.
It wasn't big enough at that point. Eventually, they poked a small hole in the basket, but still they had to use a stick to retrieve the ball.
How about a larger hole, James?
No, like, this is right.
James Naismith, who is a doctor, he's got his PhD, he's a professor, he invented one of the most popular games of all time, and he couldn't think to put a hole in the basket.
It didn't even have to be up on a pole. You could say, let's see if it'll actually drop down through. What happens if it gets in there? No, they didn't think about
that. Well, that's the end of everything.
That's it.
Yeah.
1620.
We had to use that basket later. It's peach season coming up soon.
Well, not with the hole out.
Right.
Yeah. That was so it took a while for them to iron out the kinks there. And the Mayflower, December 21st, 1620, the Pilgrims land at Plymouth Rock. And, you know, they thought it was like Virginia was the whole East Coast. So they thought, well, okay, this isn't
Virginia-ish.
So bad. Virginia-ish. That's right. Because they had tried before that Jamestown and 1602, and that was a little bit too south. Well, let's go a little north. I'm sure we'll do much better there. Mm-hmm. It seems to work out pretty well.
Seems to have worked out okay. Yeah. Well, until it took them 150 years to ratify the Bill of Rights, but, you know. So much has gone on
so
in Boston.
Much.
So much. You have no idea.
That's right. But, you know, I would equally say so much has gone on here in North Carolina that that really you see the role that the press plays across the colonies where news goes back and forth, which is kind of important.
We got time for one more, we're already out of time.
Okay, all right. I will mention that December 23rd, 1823 is when... the famous Christmas poem is first published. 'Twas the night before Christmas.
There you go.
And so on that happy note, ho, 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 hope you have a good holiday until we speak again.
All right. That was History Matters with Scott Washington. Thank you so much, as always.
You too.